Chapter 5. Vengeful Spirit. We brought Morriana before Abaddon, not as the messenger she claimed to be, but as the prisoner she truly was. She walked between two of my rubrici, and no matter how prepared she was, she still flinched at the wall of sound that met us when we walked onto the bridge. The fleet was at muster by the time we boarded the Vengeful Spirit. Even as we translated in system, other vessels were breaking into the sanctuary of our nebula, engines running hot, seeking to fall into anchor formation around the flagship. I heard Ashokai's voice long before I set foot on the Spirit.
I sense great unrest around you.
His psychic tone was usually touched by his former role as my master, yet now it was discoloured by urgency and concern.
Explain yourself, Sakandor, he said,
using the variant of my name from its classical Gothic roots.
Why are the tides of fate crashing against your soul?
As dramatic as ever. I should have realized he would sense Morriana's presence the moment we translated in system. We bring a captive from Melium.
That would explain the warp's turmoil around your vessel.
We had been slowed on our return, true. I was not even close to being as gifted at navigating through the tumbling tides of ice space as Ashokai was, though I had returned as swiftly as I was able. You sound uneasy, my brother.
All is not well, Sakandor. The Jovine and Zaidu are about to kill one another, apportioning blame for their losses at Thylacus. Valikar, Seraxia, and Vortigern have returned bloodied by fleets sworn to Daravek. We encountered our own difficulties with his minions as well. Can you not see the ship?
I could. On the Oculus, the Vengeful Spirit was clawed, prow to stern, with superficial damage, the extent of which did not worry me. The simple presence of it did. It had been dueling vessels that were strong enough to break through its shields. Tell me everything, I sent.
Just get to the command deck.
I heard the age-old commanding tone of my former mentor in that order.
You will see for yourself.
And so I did. A wall of sound, the uproar of rage and recrimination washed over us as we entered the bridge. The bridge, after a battle, was usually a place of celebration, and not uncommonly, drunken or ecstatic torture of enemy warlords. Their corpses, or soon-to-be corpses, were hauled into place among the war banners hanging from the Strategium's roof, and warriors engaged in raucous contests of strength, vows of brotherhood or violent displays of adrenal joy to celebrate the victories that brought these new trophies. I've been told that Imperial Space Marines somberly reflect after their triumphs, kneeling in monastic reverence before statues of their idols and worshipping representations of their heroes. A somewhat different aesthetic to the pit fights, the howls and the cheers that follow our victories, where bragging is an art and a warrior's reputation is all. Yet the sensation I walked into on the bridge that day was thicker, somehow fouler than usual. The frustration of hundreds of beaten warriors, their emotions meshing, created a psychic echo of their defeat that settled upon me like a funeral shroud. Tokugra was the first to greet me. Ashokai's demon crow fluttered to alight upon my shoulder, regarding me with eyes that had seen stars born and die, and had shined with amusement all the while.
Bye,
it greeted me. I had not been boy to Ashokai for centuries. The days of my adolescent apprenticeship were long past, but Tokugra referred to me by nothing else. Nagual snarled at the crow. The two demon familiars glared at one another in bestial dislike, before, as ever, the crow took wing and put distance between itself and its warp kin. The command deck was alive with heaving bodies and shouting voices. Most of the activity centered around the raised dais, where Abaddon's throne sat unused. Warriors were yelling accusations and refutations, demanding answers from each other, and demanding that others heed their words. "Stay close to me," I told Morriana, and threaded the same command through the minds of the rubrici that guarded her. We passed beneath Ultio, the anamnesis, in the chamber's very heart. She turned gracefully in the pale azure fluid of her suspension tank. She was the calm heart of the storm, serene in her amniotic haven amidst the shouting masses. The cognition cables tendrilling from her head to the machinery atop her life support prison swayed gently in the artificial womb fluid, forming a serpentine crest where each industrial snake carried her thoughts throughout the ship's receptive systems. The fluid was clean, constantly filtered and infused with nutrients by the humming machines set in the tall glass tank's foundations. She stared forwards, scarcely seeing with her eyes at all. Her vision was spread across the many thousands of gun imagifiers and hull scryers set along the vengeful spirit's battlements. When she spoke, her mouth moved but produced no bubbles in the artificial womb fluid. Her words intoned across the bridge with a voice not wholly unlike the way she had spoken before her immersion. "Sister," I sent to her.
"Hezekiah," she said,
the black stone vox gargoyles in the chamber's rafters calling out above the multitude.
"Iskandar, Telemachon, and Amuriel have returned."
In life, she had been Itzara, a young woman of Tisca. In death, she had first become the Anamnesis, machine spirit at the heart of the warship Talok, and then, gaining strength and identity upon fusion with a new vessel, she had become Ultio, the heart of the vengeful spirit. She was the ship itself, and its hull was an extension of her body, its armor plating her skin, its plasma reactors her organs. She swirled a hand through the fluid of her tomb cradle, not quite a wave of greeting. Her thoughts were a ceaseless process of trajectories, damage calculations, and a deeply resonant awareness of the souls aboard the ship she commanded. It was painful to touch a mind like that for too long. Too inhuman. Abaddon watched from the raised dais where his throne was set, though he considered the command throne to be little more than pageantry, sitting on it only when receiving emissaries or supplicants from other warbands. Sargon intercepted me before I could reach the throne. He wore the blackened ceramite we all wore, though his was bedecked in tattered scrolls I had no intention of reading. The monkish surplice he wore over the battered power armor was pockmarked and war-torn, its painstakingly inked scripture ruined by scorch holes. He looked young, barely more than a Legion initiate, his smooth skin the typical duskiness of those born and raised in the City of Grey Flowers on the long-lost desert world of Colchis. He had lacked vocal cords since long before I had met him, purportedly losing them to a cutthroat in the siege of the Imperial Palace. For several years he had relied exclusively on the hand gestures of Legiones Astartes' battle sign, and using his simplistic psychic efforts to speak through the mouths of any nearby corpses. Time had changed the method, if not the need. His shoulder guards were warp-fashion things, horned demonic faces of bioceramite, leering from the armor plating, slavering bloody spittle, occasionally lashing their two long tongues at the air. It was through these faces that he spoke, both voices in guttural harmony.
"Iskandar,"
the two faces spoke. Neither of them looked at me. For reasons beyond me, both were always blindfolded with layers of chains. They licked their fanged teeth, chittering to themselves between words. "Sargon," I greeted him. "What is all this?"
"Revenge," he said, leaning me onwards. "The gods have a sense of humour, if this madness is anything to judge by. Half our fleets limped back to the muster. Every captain and warlord brings the same tale. Legion resistance. Organised Legion resistance. Tagus Daravek took your latest attempt on his life personally."
I said nothing, not wishing to speak yet again of my failure.
"You should have killed him, Kaon."
Sargon's youthful features remained gentle as he gripped a howling female beast-man by the back of the neck and hurled her out of the way. Her herdkin scattered before our advance.
"Worse,"
Sargon continued.
"He savaged the war gods more, and the Shrieking Masquerade. Lehiovine blames Zaidu. Zaidu blames Lehiovine."
I had no chance to answer. He blindly backhanded another crew member aside. The servitor toppled into those nearby, and we pushed through the crowd together, where most of the Ezekarian had gathered around Abaddon's dais, surrounded by dozens of their warriors. Here, the feeling of frustrated defeat blanketing the chamber reached its apex. Xaidu was facing Lahir, ahead of baying packs of their men. Xaidu, bedecked in skulls on chains, his armor scraped bare of color, was a clawed and avian malformation of a man. Taloned feet scratched the plasteel decking beneath him. The turbines on his back whined, powering up with his acidic thoughts. Every movement he made was a sudden jerk or a twitch, adding to the aura of ravenous energy he exuded. The laughter through his sleek helm was a staccato croaking.
Your words, Firefist, they are a child's puling wails.
Don't call me Firefist.
Lahir's dark patchwork face showed rows of glinting metal teeth. Shivers ran through him, not a sign of fear, but of physiological desecration and simple blood need. The nails were biting into his brain. He was struggling to keep control of himself. Xaidu managed to cackle and growl at the same time, evidence of mutation within his throat.
Your words,
he said again.
They are the bleating of a weakling.
Lahir roared, spit flying from his metal teeth.
I lost men because of this creature's cowardice.
He levelled his chain axe at Xaidu, but his words were aimed at Abaddon.
We lost the battle because of this harpy. Let me kill him, Ezekiel.
Abaddon stood halfway up the stairs leading to his throne. He looked gaunter than even when I had last seen him, his jaundiced features speckled with blood from who knew how many hours, days or weeks before.
Calm yourself,
our overlord commanded with a tired sneer. Never had I seen him look so exhausted.
You're frothing at the mouth, Lehiovine. I want his head!
Zaidu's reply was a laughing screech that had all the charm and humanity of talons raking over sheet metal.
The masquerade did all that was asked of us, Lord Abaddon. Firefist's warriors failed to hold their lines. The war gods more, they are weak. Derevik's men killed them before we could reach them.
Lahir drew his hand back, ready to slam his axe blade into the deck.
No!
I sent in an urgent blade of psychic warning. To drive a weapon into the ground before a brother was to initiate a blood challenge, a Chthonian gang ritual that Abaddon had allowed, even encouraged, to spread through our warbands. Lahir's face twitched as his cranial implants reacted with boiling heat to the unwanted pressure of my silent voice in his mind. But it was enough to force a moment's hesitation. He lowered the blade. The watching crowd bayed their disappointment. Telemachon shoved past me, moving to Zaidu's side, and the jeers turned at once to cheers. The crowd scented blood now.
Say nothing more, brother, Telemachon ordered his lieutenant. Let's cut to the truth, shall we?
Xaidu immediately nodded in wordless compliance, remaining at his lord's side. Lahir looked between the two of them, still straining to hold himself back with the leash of Abaddon's wishes.
Lyrus!
Lahir made the name an accusing growl.
Your dog cost us the battle at the Thylacus Expanse.
Xaidu indeed said nothing, at least not aloud. I could hear the faint click of vox relays from his helm, as well as Telemachon's.
In my absence, Sub-Commander Vorolas is invested with my full authority, Telemachon said calmly.
His aura rippled with the first stirrings of excitement, of anticipation finally ripening. Lahir kept his eyes on Telemachon.
We have picked feats, gun imagifiers, vox archives, and sworn oaths that stand testament to your bastard sub-commander failing to reinforce us and leaving my vanguard to die.
Ah, how familiar, I thought, though my blood was running cold. I did not like the prickling amusement radiating from Xaidu. It was a piss stain of smug satisfaction souring his aura. This unfortunate scene had the ripe stink of premeditation.
I understand your displeasure, Telemachon replied, as reasonably as I had ever heard him sound. And I trust Sub-Commander Varelis's account differs from yours?
Xaidu twitched one shoulder, followed by a tick jerk of his head.
We fought to get them, Lord Lyrus. How we fought. But the war gods more. They know nothing of tactics. They cannot hold to a battle plan. They advance too far too fast. Firefist's men, they were already taking savage losses by the time we reached them.
Lahir's response to this was, by his standards, rather calm. He spat onto the deck before Zaidu's boots, the acid eating through the metal floor.
You're a liar, Zaidu.
Lahior followed the disrespectful gobbet with more accusations.
A liar, a coward, and your word isn't worth a damn here. I am Lahior of the Ezakarian, and I say you lie.
He looked to Abaddon for support, but none came. I stared at Abaddon's passivity, and in that moment the die was cast. Lahior threw his axe. It hammered into the deck before Zaidu's boots. The raptor cackled his nasty excuse for laughter. Telemachon's aura flared with the caress of rich, snide delight. He was the one that stepped forwards, his hands on his sheathed swords.
I hear your words, my dear brother, and like you, I am of the Ezakarian. As sub-commander Varalis's commanding officer, I accept the challenge in his place.
Lahior spat again. He wiped his mouth with the back of his gauntlet.
I challenge your pet, Lyrus, not you.
Indeed.
Telemachon turned fractionally to Zaidu, and their two helms bent together in melodramatic affirmation.
Do you see the axe on the deck, sub-commander Varalis?
Zaidu's reply came as a reassuring hiss.
I do, Lord Lyrus.
The theatrical innocence in his vile voice was beyond grating.
Then I accept the challenge on sub-commander Varalis's behalf, Telemachon restated. Such is my right as his lord.
To his credit, or rather in an unsurprising sign of his own zealotry, Lahior did not hesitate. He drew the saw-toothed flensing knife at his hip and stepped forwards, facing our warband's finest warrior with a naked grin.
Is that what you want? I care not whose blood runs for this, Lyrus, yours or that screaming dog's. It's all the same to me.
In the years to come, I would often think back to this moment. The sight of Lahior advancing on Telemachon, our warband's finest bladesman, carrying nothing but a skinning knife in his hand. Lahior is long dead now, fallen on Machan, as I have said before. But this is the man I remember, the grinning and confident warrior that faced the perfect swordsman carrying only a dagger.
Ezekiel, I sent to my lord, do something before this madness gets further out of hand.
Abaddon watched and said nothing. He looked weary beyond reckoning, but his eyes met mine and he nodded, finally giving me the signal I needed. I drew Sacramentum, and she flashed sacred silver into the strategium's sick light.
Enough!
My command was both spoken and driven into the minds of everyone present. The beastmen whined and lowered their heads in submission. The warriors regarded me with a mixture of reluctant obedience and resentment that I had stepped forwards to break the promise of bloodsport. Telemachon did not look at me.
You have no right interfering, Luxandru.
Lahior shared the sentiment.
Oh, you can have his pretty burial mask, Kaon, once I've carved it from his skull.
I cut the air between them with Sacramentum's shining length. You, I addressed Telemachon, are dueling no one on anyone's behalf. You think me blind to this transparent ploy? And you, I aimed my blade at Zaidu, may expect my summons later. If you refuse to speak the truth in this matter, Zaidu Varalas, I will tear it from your mind. I looked between Zaidu and Lahior. Now both of you, back down. Zaidu obeyed at once, moving away with Telemachon, but Lahior did not. Spittle gleamed on his chin, and he watched their retreating forms with bloodshot eyes, still gunning his chain axe.
Cowards!
He drooled the word with a stalactite of saliva, then shouted it louder, setting off another chorus of cheers. I pulled Lahior aside, dragging him by the pauldron.
You foolish bastard.
He winced at the silent knife of my voice, cursing me and snapping back,
Get out of my head!
You foolish bastard,
I said aloud the second time. Above us, Altio drifted in her tank, her nude form a silhouette in the amniotic fluid of her artificial womb. Several of the Syntagma stood nearby. The war robots and cognitively enslaved cyborgs she commanded were bristling with weaponry. The human and mutant crew knew to stay clear of her mechanical enforcers. To the beastmen clans that served us, the Syntagma were machine angels that obeyed the ship's soul. Lahior bared his iron teeth, his features twitching. A particularly painful spasm forced one of his eyes to screw closed and his mouth to pull to the side for two heartbeats.
You're lecturing me, you uptight cur!
The shrieking masquerade caused more casualties among my warriors than that god's cursed Daravek you failed to kill. Zaidu is lucky. I brought my grievance before Abaddon instead of killing him back on the Phylacus battlefield.
Luck had nothing to do with it. One of the ways Abaddon promoted unity was by overseeing disputes and duels between chieftains and warlords himself, rather than letting them slaughter each other out of his sight, according to their own whims. A subtle touch, but one of the many ways in which he sought to impose laws over our chaotic way of life. If nothing else, I admired his monarchical intentions. Zaidu is baiting you, I said to Lihior. I cannot imagine that you do not see that.
I see it.
Lihior sucked his saliva back through his teeth.
I'm not blind. That Nostromon wretch pulled his heart from his chest.
And if that challenge had been allowed, I interrupted, Telemachon will fight in Zaidu's place. If Ezekiel had not ordered me to act, brother, you would be locking blades with the masked prince this very moment, instead of receiving a lecture from me.
I'd rather have the duel.
The heel's left eye screwed shut as his cheek gave another wrenching spasm. Anger still rippled from him in an unpleasant breath against my sixth sense, but it was lessening now, a tide on its way out.
The masked prince,
Lihior said in a growl.
I cut him to pieces.
I stared at him for several seconds, amazed, truly amazed, that he honestly believed what he was saying. Deluded or not, and he most certainly was, if he thought he could outfight Telemachon, Lihior was calming down. That was good. That was all I needed for now. I turned back to seek Moriana, only to see her slipping free of my rubriquet, moving forwards, a dark serenity spreading through the crowd around her. This lone, unaugmented human strode towards Abaddon, strode past mutants and monsters and warriors, and we watched her as if enspelled. Surprise was writ plain across many of my brother's faces. Even the mutants and braying beastmen, who had been so eagerly praying for bloodshed to erupt between their masters, for there was no finer entertainment than seeing their betters bleed, fell silent. Moriana walked to the base of Abaddon's dais, and there she stood, as tall and regal as a human could amidst a horde of monsters and mutants and gene-forged warriors, the least of which still towered above her.
Ezekiel Abaddon,
she said, her gaze lifted to his.
May we speak?
He stared at her, and I will never forget how he showed no surprise at her manifestation. I do not know if he knew her from before our exile to the Eye, nor if he had been expecting her, but I do know that there was no surprise in his eyes when she stood before him. Perhaps he was merely too drained to react, but I do not believe so. There was something else at work that day. Perhaps the fate that our seers and prophets prattle of at such length.
Speak.
Abaddon bade her with a ripple of the talon. Moriana spoke. She told my gathered brothers and sisters what she had already told me, Amuriel and Telemachon on the graveyard world of the 16th Legion. Back on Malium, she had claimed to be a seer. More than that, she swore she had foreseen our arrival within Horus's tomb. Moriana had been on Malium for some time, drawn by its spiritual resonance and its place at the crossroads of fate. She claimed to know nothing of the downed Black Templar's vessel, and her aura flickered with truth when she made that claim. She likewise knew little of those black-clad warriors herself, deflecting our irritation by insisting she had far worthier tales to tell. We let her speak. As she did so, she led us from the crypt, back to the wreckage-strewn surface, and onwards into the wilderness of the eternal rust yards. All the while she spoke of how her dreams had driven her into the Eye itself, and then to Malium.
I bring a warning to Abaddon, of a rival to his throne by the name of Tagus Daravek. More than that, I bring word of the Imperium as it is, not the Empire that you once knew.
The possibility of deceit was foremost in our minds, yet how could we resist such law? She answered our questions, some clearly, some with evasions. The Imperium she spoke of was a realm unreal to us, In the centuries since we brought fire to the sky above the Imperial Palace, our names and deeds were not just consigned ever deeper into history, they were increasingly woven into mythology. Knowledge of the rebellion, a conflict she called the Horus Heresy, the first time I ever heard those words spoken, was ever more guarded and sequestered. Imperial authorities twisted what had happened in the war when they acknowledged it at all, and it was far more common to suppress any facts through sanction and even execution. Worlds deemed too tainted by the truth were declared forbidden ground, blockaded from trade and transit, struck from astrocartographic charts, and severed from astropathic communion until generations had passed. Some were even cleansed of life and resettled by harvests of colonists and itinerant pilgrim populations. Hope and ambition were no longer the currencies of mankind. In an age of spreading peace, the truth was becoming myth. The people of humanity's empire turned their devotion to soulful adherence in prayer and duty, while the Imperium's armies forgot how they had once warred upon each other, and instead turned their weapons outwards, to the Xenos races that had retaken their territories after the failed Great Crusade had dissolved in civil war. I listened in absolute awe. Nothing in the mists of her aura suggested any deception. If anything, she seemed to be taking care with her words, for fear of overwhelming us or provoking incredulity. I wished for nothing more than to tear her mind apart, ransacking her memories for all she had seen and all she had felt within this new Imperium. The only thing that stopped me was simple caution. She was adamant that she must meet with Abaddon, and I knew my lord would need to meet this outlander for himself. Moriana spoke on. Whole worlds had been reshaped, their continents given over to graveyards and necropolises, mourning not the slain on either side of a nearly forgotten war, but the more recent dead of the last several hundred years, the innocent martyrs of the God Emperor's faithful flock. The God Emperor. The God Emperor. Language cannot convey the effect those words had on me. I will do all I can to explain it, knowing that every explanation is wrong, for no wordcraft can truly shape an impression of what I felt the first time I heard that title. The God Emperor. Moriana said it again when Amuriel asked her to repeat herself. He had stopped as if struck, his thoughts running so acidly rancid that I felt them pressing against my senses. Telemachon had been exultant, roaring his laughter to the sky, so gripped by euphoric revelation that I thought his twin hearts might seize. If you've ever walked on Asylum's halls, you know that laughter. It is something beyond mirth, beyond elation. It is a release, a dam that breaks in the back of the mind to let madness pour forth, preventing the brain from drowning in poison. The God Emperor. I tried to repeat Moriana's words, but my mouth refused to give them shape. I was laughing myself. Telemachon could barely breathe. The laughter soared in and out of his faceplate's vocalizer, wheezing and wet, hacking as if he'd ruptured something in his throat. Amuriel stood dumb, trying to process what he had heard. Trying and failing. Yet Moriana was far from finished. She spoke on, telling us of the cult of the Emperor Savior emerging from the disorder of the rebellion's aftermath. Uprisings of this cult were commonplace on countless worlds, subsuming whole systems in this tide of new belief. The Emperor, revered as the source of the Astronomicon, allowed travel between humanity's scattered worlds. The Emperor, master of mankind, bane of aliens, the one true deity. A god. They believed the Emperor was a god. I knew how and why this had happened, even before she said another word. It happened as it always happens, as any scholar of their own species' history can tell you. It happened because the helpless masses were fearful, and because the powerful wanted unchallenged control. Every religion rises for the same reasons.
The lower tiers of society crave answers and comfort, needing rewards in an afterlife to justify the harshness and grimness of their lives. And to prevent uprisings in search of better existences, their rulers institute a creed that keeps the masses obedient and compliant. Meekness, obedience, submission. These become virtues that the oppressed must embody in pursuit of a greater good or a later reward. To stand against the prevailing belief becomes not just philosophy, but heresy. Heresy worthy of execution. And so control is maintained by the strong over the weak. The God Emperor, I finally managed to say. There have been many times in my life since then that I have cursed that title or cringed at hearing it cried by his deluded followers. But that day, damn me for my naivety, I was laughing with Telemachon. A cruel, spurned mirth, not the amusement of the victor, but the bleak joy of the beaten. That laughter was a purging, like shedding an uncomfortable sheath of skin. Much of the Imperium already adheres to the word of the sect as gospel, Moriana continued. The temple of the Emperor Saviour has a far wider reach and deeper roots than the petty cults that flowered during your rebellion. The Lectitio Divinitatis was a child's bedtime candle compared to the sunlight of the beliefs now gripping the Imperium. All these thousands of years later, deep in what scholars name the Dark Millennium, the Ecclesiarchy grips the whole Imperium in an inviolate hold. Moriana spoke of its rise as an inexorable ascension, only a handful of centuries before its formal final adoption as the imperial creed, backbone of the Adeptus Ministerium, state religion of the Imperium of Man. And all of it, founded from the very beliefs that the Emperor had sought to destroy. Just as the Emperor had been betrayed by his sons, so too had the fool been betrayed by his own empire. Blind and rudderless without its monarch to guide it, the Imperium was devolving into superstitions and half-truths. No wonder we were already close to being myths.
The word-bearers won!
Telemachon was on his hands and knees in the dust, blood trickling from his unmoving silver mouth. He laughed and heaved and vomited and laughed, speaking between dragged breaths and violent convulsions.
The word-bearers won. They eat dirt and drink shame. They chant prayers to the unwanted truth through bloodied lips. They lost everything, and yet they still won.
I did not fight for the word-bearers' vision,
Amuriel snapped.
None of us did. Our ideals were higher and worthier than the pedantics of divinity.
He looked at me as if expecting my support. I could not give it. What ideals could I claim, truly? I had fought in the rebellion because there was no choice. The wolves raised Prospero and stole the choice from us. I waged war upon terror because my side was chosen for me. What of you? I asked Moriana. You are older than your physical form. Your soul is far older than your flesh. You have lived for centuries within this new Imperium, have you not? What then of your beliefs? She stared at me, measuring me by some silent criteria. I could tell from the flaring corona of her aura that my words had surprised her. I felt her thoughts shifting, following this new path.
I believe the same, she admitted. For many years I believed him to be a god. I was instrumental in spreading the belief myself.
Images, memories swirled slowly behind her eyes. Before they could resolve, she somehow felt me looking within her skull. A wall of mist swarmed across my sixth sense. I had met no other mortal who could defend themselves with such swiftness and ease, but I'd seen enough to confirm my suspicions. You still believe it?
I know what I know, she said.
Her voice turned melancholy, but ironclad in the same moment, all doubt gone.
A god or not, his power renders him indistinguishable from divinity.
And this is not the kind of theosophic discussion our liege lord enjoys, I warned her.
No. And yet you'll take me to Abaddon, whether you wish it or not, because you know he would never forgive you for leaving me here. There is more that I cannot say now. So much of what I know is only for Abaddon to hear.
For his ears alone?
For his ears first.
You expect us to allow that? She endured my doubt with a priestess's patience.
You'll have to accept it, Kaon. Not only here and now, but in the many years to come.
There was no unkindness in those words, yet they made my skin crawl. Telemachon was still coughing and chuckling.
Oh, perfect, he was saying. Perfection itself.
I had to help him to his feet.
Medic!
He called out mockingly to Amuriel as I lifted him to stand.
I fail to see what's so amusing in all this, said Amuriel.
Oh, the perfect jest, Telemachon replied, a grin in his honeyed voice. Don't you see? We are all part of the perfect jest.
All of this she told Abaddon and those of us gathered on the command deck. Telemachon was speaking softly among a group of his shrieking masquerade warriors. Lahior was calm, stunned to silence. Amuriel looked disgusted. None of us moved, none but Ultio, who turned in her amniotic sanctuary, looking down across the crowd at one warrior in particular.
Ezekiel, she asked.
Her voice was a murmur from the mouths of 100 brass gargoyles in the rafters. The vengeful spirit itself, proud to stern, shuddered in sympathy with her concern. She was a weapon, a beast of war, and she feared for the soul of her master. Abaddon watched Morianna, his eyes glassy, mouth parted to show a glint of his filed, rune-etched teeth. He inclined his head, a reassurance for the ship's machine spirit, and a bid for Morianna to continue. The prophetess spoke on. I will not relay everything she said. Much of it you already know from Imperial annals, and a great deal more holds no relevance all these thousands of years later. To us, it was madness strung together in sentences. To you, it would simply be history. Even as I relate the details now, my recitation conveys none of her moments of indecision or the halts within her speech. Morianna has never been a natural speaker. A listener, perhaps. It has been my experience that she hears everything spoken and uses it to her advantage when the time is right. But she lacks a demagogue's easy charisma or a preacher's fervent conviction. And yet we all stood rapt as she ministered to us with the unwelcome truth. The imperfections in her delivery that day only added to her sincerity. The hesitations in her cadence as she sought the right words only reinforced the importance of what she had to convey. And so we listened, drawn into the spell she wove. One of her most compelling habits was to speak without meeting her listener's eyes. Her head tilted just so, her gaze unfocused, as though she was used to relying on senses beyond sight.
I feel your anger,
Morianna called out to us as she neared the end. Her voice was cracked and dry.
I see your broken battle plate and the dried blood of your wounds, and I am here to share a warning beyond the words I have already spoken. I have walked the many webs of fate. The greatest threat to your ascension rises with you now. He hears the same call to unity that you all hear. He follows the same goals along far different paths. You know him as Tagus Daravek, the Lord of Hosts.
It would be an exaggeration to say that every eye turned to me in that moment, but many did. The Ezekarian, privy to Abaddon's plans, along with their closest warriors, they all glanced towards me. At my side, Lahior gave a dirty grunting chuckle at the sudden shift in attention, while I heard Telemachon's mellifluous laughter from across the chamber.
Tagus Daravek, Morianna repeated. In every future where he lives, Ezekiel Abaddon does not. In every future where he unites the legions, the vengeful spirit burns in the void. If he leaves the eye and steals your fate from you, then your newborn legion dies.
The bridge dissolved into immediate uproar. Morianna raised her hands to bid the crowd to be silent, though her efforts were useless. The roars went on, adding to the percussive thunder of weapons beating against armor in militant rhythm.
I heard and felt no paucity of rage in that bellowing cry. It unnerved me in a way little else could, for it laid bare the arrogance with which we draped ourselves. We had grown so strong, so used to our own victories, that the idea of defeat had become anathema. Perhaps, just perhaps, it also resonated a little too much like fear. I looked back to Moriana. Abaddon had descended to her side, and he lifted the talon high, lightning snapping between its bladed claws, bringing the gathering to a swift silence. He did not need to say a word. The gesture itself was enough. Moriana thanked him with a nod.
"Kill Tagus Derevek," she said to him. "Kill him, and take your place beneath the gaze of the Pantheon. This is your destiny."
That word again. How it plagues this tale. "Destiny," I sent to Amuriel in irritated disgust, but Ashrakai overheard my psychic derision. He pulsed his disapproval to me from his raised platform above the bridge, where, as the warship's voidseer, he guided the vengeful spirit through the tortured heavens. "Do not lecture me," I sent back before he could do so. His attempts to convince me of the merits of prophecy had already failed over several centuries, and his reprimand was easy to ignore now. Prophecy, destiny, fate. The infinite power of hindsight. Prophets or prophetesses may speak whatever they wish and apply it like a soothing salve over the wounds of any event, once the moment has already passed. Prophecy is unreliable at best, and the embarrassing artistry of charlatans at worst. Abaddon, silent all this time, finally spoke. He said that which I had hoped to hear, the only words that mattered. "You speak of the Pantheon's gaze, but I will never bow to the forces that deceived Horus Lupercal." Moriana looked up at our lord, ferocity in her dark eyes.
"But Tagus Derevek will, and he will take your place on the paths of fate."
I felt like spitting. Surely my brother could not be dragged in by superstition and naked manipulation. "Ezekiel," I said, "must we listen to this?" Sargon looked aghast at my interruption, as did Ashrakai. Both were clinging to Moriana's every word. Abaddon gestured for me to hold my tongue, though there was no anger there.
"Let her finish, Iskander. Let's see where this leads. Tagus Derevek has been a thorn in our side for decades, prophetess. But why do you so fiercely demand his death? What does he intend to do?"
"He intends what you intend, Ezekiel Abaddon. That which calls to you also calls to him, and already he makes ready to claim it before you can. Despite all of your ambitions, you are left with a simple choice. Wield the sword that you see in your dreams, or be killed by it."